I actually had thought originally, I actually had prepared a whole sheet to start, to continue in discussing concert issues, but then this morning, I happened to see a Facebook post that someone posted about disabilities and shul. Apparently, there's like a slight controversy in Israel at this moment. Apparently, there's some documentary about someone who has an autistic child who came to shul with a child, and the rabbi said, you're not allowed to come into shul, and if you're like, I can bring you to all the rabbis if you want, and like, there's no one to tell you not to go to shul. So the post I saw was commenting on that and, well, arguing with it. But I didn't see the documentary. I can't, like, argue it's true, it didn't happen, or it did happen. What I do know, though, is that there are a number of tshuvot that address not exactly that issue, but similar issues. And it's a little bit more nuanced than just yes or no. But I do think it's worth reading, and so I wanted to quote two different tshuvos, if we have time, that deal with these type of issues that I think are, yeah, rather informative as to how we deal with these type of things.
Is dochening included in what you're going to say in terms of?
I'm actually not dealing with dochening yet. Definitely, it's a little bit more complicated because dochening kohanim, it's a little bit more complicated. But we can talk about dochening at the end. Okay, take a look at the Chatham Sofer one. This is the one that has the Shelter Chuvot at the very top. This is very last minute, so I don't even have a title. I just copied it. So the Chatham Sofer writes the Chuvot. I actually don't know if there's a date for this, but he lived in the 1800s in Pressburg in Hungary. And he writes the following Chuvot. Yikatev yechatem le'alter l'chaim tovim v'arukim. Harav agon talmidei harav havati kachar tamuflag etzav al beitin. Logash. So some guy who is a Talmud of his with a lot of compliments about him writes him the following question. Higiani nimiotav shelat chacham chati tshuva odot shliach sibor b'shochit mumcha zaken v'ragil mechol midot shemenu chazal. So there is this individual in the community who is a well, there's two parts to this question. Number one, he's a shochet, he's a butcher, he's a halachic butcher. And two, he's also a shliach tzibur. And he has a beautiful voice, and he's, you know, been doing this for many years, and everyone knows that he's like a great individual, his midot are great, v'kolo arev v'na'im zmirot, and he has all of these, you know, perfect, very nice voice. However,
what does that word mean? That phrase.
Like half a tshuva. It's a little bit unclear. What? Yeah. I don't know what the original is. It sounds like maybe it's only half a tshuva or something, or maybe it's like it's not fully explained.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm not totally sure. Maybe, yeah. So, ach leprakim. So this individual, despite all of his fine qualities, ach leprakim nichper rachman litzman becholi hanofel. Sometimes he is bent over with Rahman Litzlan, with this type of illness that makes him fall over. And many times this happens in the morning during Shacharit. Because many of the doctors have said it comes from some type of heart weakness because he hasn't eaten anything in the morning. And so his falling creates a tremor in the congregation, because everyone sees him falling, everyone's like, oh my gosh, what's happening? So this individual, because he's so, he's so frail, so he doesn't really get his strength again the rest of the day. So therefore, Alkein Arina says Shoel v'Zeiv Hadareish Ikasher l'Shchita. So two questions are relevant. One, number one, can this individual be a shochet? Because when it comes to the concept of shchita, the following rule is mentioned in the Shulchan Aruch: the afilu bichlal lachalmu oto. Even during the time that he's, you know, not, he's sane, that he's not sick, when he doesn't have this illness. So we can be concerned that perhaps there is like a liminal space between when an individual kind of loses their faculties. So the Shulchan Aruch mentions that perhaps we're always concerned that someone might lose their faculties right at the moment that, I guess, they're Lov Shchita, even though it looks like they were, you know, they're fully with it, but maybe like that moment was the beginning of, you know, they lost the faculties and they hadn't, you know, and the street that ever would be possible. So Schoenhorn seems to mention that as a potential problem. So this would be potentially be an issue here as well. So that's number question number one. Vizot Sheini, second question is, Iro'ui Lishloach Sibor. Can this individual be a Shliach Sibor? Can he serve as a Chazan? Viprak Demim Menoraim, and especially not just on a regular, you know, Shabbos or day of the week, but especially on the high holidays, can he be a Shliach Sibor? De'ein Lecha Mum Gadol Mizeh, because there is no larger mum, there's no larger blemish. De'harei Nichpeh Pasul Avodah, because anyone who's bent, who can't stand up straight, is Pasul Avodah, can't work as a Kohen in the Beit Mikdash. V'ikanami Mishum HaKrivu Na'alech Tech'techa. And not only that, but there's Mishloach Darolich Ne'melech Basar Adam, Yishliach Kazeh, because there's also a principle, not only is there one principle that apostles people for davening if they have a mum, if they have something that have a blemish, because Gohanim couldn't serve in the Beit HaMikdash based on blemishes. But there's also a principle that ultimately Shliach Dibor is acting as our messenger in front of God, and if you wouldn't send an individual who has blemishes, who has certain disabilities in front of a king as your messenger, so you wouldn't have him, you know, daven in front of you, you shouldn't have him daven either. And maybe even you go further and say that maybe regardless of whether he davens, maybe he shouldn't even be allowed in the shul. Because maybe there'll be some weak-hearted individuals and children who will see him when he's sick, and they will get scared and they'll get sick themselves. And this is probably the main reason. There are some people who are from the community who are disgusted by it. This is honestly probably the main thing. And at the same time, though, there are some people who want him to be in the shul because he has a nice voice. And he's an individual who's poor and he's troubled. And he's a person who is, you know, a real tzaddik, and he's, you know, he's yashar, he's straight in front of Kodesh Baruch Hu. So therefore this question was asked about this individual. Can he serve as a shochet? Can he serve also as a shliach tzibur? I'll mention that it's not entirely clear from this tshuva, but I think most people think that this individual referring to here is suffering from epilepsy. That's, like, I think, the typical way of understanding exactly the disease here. I mean, you're the doctor, you tell me.
I think that'd be unusual. Okay. You don't get epilepsy when you're that at that point in your life. I was thinking he's just either he's had heart failure or he's dehydrated in the morning and he has syncope.
Could be. I have heard this too in the context of epilepsy, but
if it actually is because he's not eating before he davens, why don't they just give him the shot that he needs before he davens, and then it won't happen.
You could have adult onset epilepsy, but it's starting now. Plus, he would lose his bowels.
That takes away from
he would lose his bowels and his urine.
I mean, that would be the simplest answer. Let him see how he does after that.
That's the other thing, is he would lose
his...
He would have urinary incontinence and bowel incontinence. It would be a mess at the shul.
If he wasn't epileptic.
Yeah, he'd be urinating in the mouth.
Or maybe that's part of... Yeah, you could say he would mention this. Yeah. Okay, it's not entirely clear.
He's diabetic, if possible.
I'm saying he has hemodynamic instability.
But I mean instead of epilepsy, could it be, you know, that he's diabetic? You know, the low sugar.
Kidney aortic stenosis, you know, can have a valvular heart disease, and he gets up and he, you know, kaplup. You know.
My first season
was
when I was 38, so...
I'm saying, you can have it, but this sounds like this guy's really advanced.
I think they're talking about, like, it's more frail than just, I think the reason they think about epilepsy is it's more than just, like, he's frail. Like, at moments of weakness, he just, like, collapses and not the strength to stand up. It sounds like he's totally incapable.
Also, most epileptics are in, you know, they have their events, and they get over it, but they don't have to stick the whole day. It's a very unusual thing.
Yeah. Well, they didn't have like medicine. Man. Yeah. Okay. I'm not. Yeah. I'm not taking any stake here. I don't know. It certainly wasn't defined as epilepsy, you know, at the time. So whatever it is.
I mean,
Either way, whatever this individual illness. So I'm skipping the Shrita. It's actually kind of interesting, but I'm going to skip the Shrita case. And I wanted to just focus actually on davening, because I think davening is interesting in of itself. And it's worth noting, I want to point out, and I'll read it, it's not like a yes or no answer. There is actually a lot of nuance here that's worth appreciating in terms of how we approach these type of questions. So this is how the Chazam Sofer answers the question. V'lavor l'ashinit, this is the second paragraph, to regard to the second question about whether you can be a shliach tzibur kovol yipalel b'yamim n'rayim, yivnei shumum aposil b'kohanim. So there are two reasons, right, that were cited as to why he couldn't be a shliach tzibur. Number one, because there is a rule that kohanim, if they want to serve in the Beit HaMikdash, they can't have a mum, they can't have some type of blemish. And seemingly this would be a blemish. Even if it's a blemish that doesn't always appear, it's called a mum nichpeh. It's a mum that sometimes comes and sometimes doesn't come, which is also considered to be a blemish, like something which...
Nichpeh with a beis or a pei?
With a pei, nichpeh. Like it's hidden, sometimes it's revealed, sometimes it's not revealed. So this will also consider to be a blemish, even if it doesn't always appear. So that would be one reason. The second reason we saw we'll come back to is the reason about this is not a great individual to as your representative in front of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. But at least with regard to the Kohanim presentation, he said, so this is the Chasam Sofer's response, V'chi kol amumin hapsulim b'avodah himself b'sheach sibur. So Chasam Sofer says rather simply, who says that every type of psul for a Kohen applies for Shneach Sibur? Now, there's a lot of discussion about how we understand psulim nowadays. I know I'm saying this tshuva very simply, but there's, certainly with our added knowledge about disabilities, I think it's a lot more complicated in terms of how we understand mums and all these type of things. But certainly, Chatham Sofer is saying, regardless of that, there's no precedent necessarily that mandates that whenever a person has a mum that disqualifies you to be a Kohen in the Beit HaMikdash, that would also disqualify you from being a Shliach Tzibur. And he gives us a proof to it. Because if so, then someone who's a lefty. Iter is a lefty, and according to many, they'd be puzzled for avodah and basic mikdash, because many of the avodah need to be done with your right hand, and they have a weak right hand. So it's a whole interesting discussion about lefties. It's not entirely necessarily true, but it's certainly a view within many Rishonim that a lefty couldn't serve the Beit HaMikdash. And, we've never heard somebody disqualified from either Shliach Tzibur because they're left-handed.
What does Mandalad stand for?
Mandamar. Le Mandamar. According to that opinion.
How about being blind?
He doesn't talk about blind here. We're going to talk about blind actually the next Shuvah. Or Moshe talks about blind. You couldn't serve as a Kohen blind, yeah.
All right, but just in terms of being a chasm.
Being a chasm, he's not addressing it here. Actually, the next two are about Rav Moshe isn't about chasm being a chasm either. Yeah. It's an interesting question. I think with blindness...
I know.
Yeah. I think with blindness, the main concern, especially back then, is you're not going to get every word right. I think back then there was like no question a blind person because they weren't going to get every word right. Especially if you're yamin derayim, the davening is a bit different. And nowadays, like especially with Braille and there are other ways they can, they can practice and other things. I don't think it's as simple, but it's an interesting question to think about and discuss. And he says, with any quotes as well, "Be'emet b'shvut Yaakov ratzal lifsol shirach tibor shiratulo lifa ishal ishto ashutit v'amar gaon shikon gada lo yelo bet batim hu adin shirach tibor." So he quotes that there was this tshuva, the Shvut Yaakov, who was a contemporary of the Chatham Sofer, who was asked the following question about an individual whose wife apparently became sick with some type of mental illness. She lost, her faculties, whatever exactly happened to her. And I don't know exactly the case here, but they permitted, the rabbis, the Beis Din, whoever it is, permitted him to marry a second wife in addition to his current wife. Interesting case on its own. I'm not really discussing it. Either way, the question was whether this individual who was married to two women, was he allowed to serve as a Shliach Tzibur? And the Shvut Yaakov said no, because a Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur was only allowed to marry one wife. And so much so that they actually, famously, the Kohen Gadol had to have like a backup wife in case his wife died, because he has to have a wife, but it has to be always a backup. It wasn't that he were actually married to two women at the same time. So the Shvut Yaakov argues that this same principle should apply here as well. So the Chatham Sofer says, what is he talking about? Kvodo, varav enem nishma'im li b'chi shliach tibor kohen gadol hu. right? Even that, if that's the principle for Kohen Gadol, who says that the Shliach Tzibur is a Kohen Gadol, right? That's a standard that we've never heard of. The Imkame and Melush, the Tzibur Shumamu Maposlo Yireid. So therefore, I'm skipping a bit, but any time a Shliach Tzibur has some type of mum, so you can't be a Shliach Tzibur. I have a mumma mechpe, nihi de posel ba kohanim, apilu vishat chil muto, mitam lishute, the itbe bekufe, have a mum. So it's true when it comes to a mumma nechpe, when it comes to a mum that's hidden, something that appears sometimes and is hidden, that even when it's hidden, even when the mum doesn't appear, even when this person looks healthy, he still can't serve as a kohen. Why? Because the fact that they have this blemish means that they are weak in some way, considered for a mum. Even though they're right now, they're not displaying any symptoms. The fact that they have, you know, that disease means that they're not ro'i to be kohanim. But about the shliach tzibur b'shach kivimuto, but when it comes to the shliach tzibur, there's no such qualification. And not only that, but he also points out, we know of plenty of people who have these type of illnesses, and yet they are capable of standing in front of kings and, you know, and dukes and ministers. And, you know, while they're sick, of course, they're usually not in front of court. But when they're not sick, these individuals serve, you know, to the fullest capacity, and we don't limit them. And therefore, in this case, this individual, if he's not, you know, currently, I guess, collapsing from his frailty, there's no reason to not have him serve as a shliach tzibur. Ach yaspek yakadav malato im ein lo zman v'idan efshar shipov eit diburo l'snei melech basar v'dam. At the same time, Sofer adds, if we don't know, if it could be that at any one moment this individual could collapse, right? It's just we don't know when it's going to happen, then the concern about having him serve as a Shliach Tzibur is a valid concern. Right? There's a little nuance here. Chazon Sofer is admitting it's not that this issue is black and white. It's true. If this individual can collapse at any one moment, we wouldn't want him to serve as a Shliach Tzibur. The same way that if there was an individual who, you know, you were appealing to a king or whatever, a queen, you know, the president for a certain message, if you were worried that at any given moment this individual could lose their faculties, you know, without any sign, without any, you know, there was no forewarning, you probably, as nice and great as you respect this individual, you probably wouldn't have them, you know, be your appointed, you know, designee or your representative. So the same thing applies here. So the Chasam Sofer agrees that in principle that's right. However, ach hare arofim shaftu shachlishuto shalze libari kana garmalo. However, Chasam Sofer notes this is true, but at the same time, I am going to do whatever I can to find a solution. I'm not going to just say usher, you know, because the easy solution is say, oh, usher, find a different chazan, you know, there are other chazanim, I'm sure, in this community, find someone else. But the Chazan Sofer doesn't end the tshuva there. Instead, Chazan Sofer says, no, based on the tshuva you wrote to me, you told me that the doctors say that his sickness comes because he has a weak or an empty heart, I think he's like empty stomach, and therefore, what's the solution? Have him eat. Have him eat before he davens. The imkain Rosh Hashanah, so therefore, even on Rosh Hashanah, Tarem alichato lebeit haknesset, before he walks the shul, shu kodem or hayom, yitam, v'pilu yochal v'yachazik libo l'itpalel. So he should eat something before he goes to shul in the morning. You know, Rosh Hashanah, have a little snack, have a little cake before he goes to shul, and that's fine. And this is assuming that in his community, I guess, this is before daybreak. So I guess Rosh Hashanah, they started davening very early. You know, like 5 in the morning, they're starting davening. So if he has before 5 in the morning, so that's fine. There's no halachic issues of eating before Nate.
How about making Kiddush after Shacharis?
So that's your second suggestion. Suggestion. So that's
no, we had it down at the ballroom with you.
Yeah. So his first suggestion is eat a little bit before davening. But if that doesn't work because, you know, you're not eating that much necessarily and you're eating, you know, at 5 in the morning, it's not really going to help you when you're davening most of at 11. So he says if that's not going to help, then v'odani omer im lo sagilei v'kach alai v'al tzavari if this isn't enough, then on me. Like, I put the blame on me and on my neck. Like, I am going to take responsibility for this, even though people might disagree and think this is bad. I will take responsibility and say that what should he do? She kadesh alayayin achar shvilat shachar kodem tkiat shofar miyushav. What should he do? He should make kiddush before tkiat shofar, after shachars, before tkiat shofar.
Alcohol on an empty stomach is not a great idea for a guy who's free.
Well, presumably he's eating other things, but hopefully. But either way, he should eat, he can make kiddush, he should eat other things, and that way you'll be able to daven. Most of you can't break it up after tkiat shofar, because then it would be a hashtag of sorts. But before tkiat shofar would be fine. Ach miyad achar tfilat shachrit yikadesh v'yisod v'yipalat in Hashem ve'az al zeh ne'emar mashakad magin Avram karov Hashem l'shivuri lev mishamesh b'kiyun shivurim. And not only that, but once you're able to, you know, find a solution, so you might say to yourself, like, okay, I can find a solution to allow him to daven, but, like, you know, want to take the risk, what's necessary. So obviously I think there's part of this is, like, you know, midat, a question of, like, how we treat our, you know, our community members and how we treat, you know, our fellow Jews. Certainly that's part of it, but the Chatzim Sofer adds, not only that, but it's also true. We have a principle that as much as we want, on the one hand, that the person who serves as our designee to be, you know, to be proper and not have a mum and be responsible and, you know, look presentable, on the other hand, we also want them to be empathetic. We want them to be someone who really has a broken heart, who really has, you know, real issues that you're davening for. And this individual, right, we want someone who, the expression is, who has broken vessels, shvuri kelim, like his vessels, his utensils are broken. You know, someone who's had to deal with real hardships in life. And Chatzim Sofer says, shari enenu kli shvur kesuma o yad v'regel kituim ha'meusim lifisha. And there's no one who's as broken as someone who's blind or someone who lost a limb. And this individual then, who in a particular moment of, you know, has his all of his faculty, his mind, you know, is not frail at this particular moment, and he can stand in front of, you know, kings. Because this individual, yes, it's true that, you know, he has his faculties right now, but the fact that he knows that he, you know, can lose his faculties at any moment, and not only that, but he's poor, and he's troubled, and he has all these other hardships, who is going to daven with as much fervor as this individual? Like, you know, if anything, you should want him to be your chazan. So that's why your Moshe said, you should have him as your chazan. Gam kein ki tachusu alaniv yagiu beito yirachim Hashem abenichem. And that way also, it'll cause you, maybe you will see him, and maybe you will also have pity on him, and you will, you know, yourself have pity for other poor people, and that will help the community, and, you know, Kadosh Baruch Hu will see that, and that itself will be helpful for, you know, like, maybe there are also ancillary benefits of seeing someone who, you know, is not fully with it. There are, you know, a lot of benefits in terms of being accustomed to it. And I think Chatzim Sofer doesn't discuss this so much here, but I think it's very much true that a lot of the problem or the critique about individuals who have some sort of abnormal behavior, mm-hmm. It's not so much about whether inherently the abnormal behavior is problematic, but it happens more often than not because people in the shul, you know, don't feel comfortable around that individual. So there is one to talk about. I don't think it's so obvious that just because, you know, if everyone's so uncomfortable, I'm not sure it's so obvious they can still come to shul or, you know, what exactly should happen. But I think it's definitely true that becoming more accustomed to individuals like this certainly makes a lot easier. The more you're around people who, you know, might collapse in shul, the more you're around people who are autistic in shul, the more you get used to it, the more you're able to, you know, appreciate it and to, you know, not have a reaction that you feel disgusted by it, because you appreciate, you know, this is a person who has, you know, has issues the same way we all have issues.
Can I just ask I don't see a word for Letzi. Was that
Itur. In King's words, the second line in the second paragraph.
Itur, right.
Itur.
Thank you.
Yeah. Iter, yeah. Ehud ben Kira. Yeah. So this individual, therefore, is a great individual to be davening, and not only that, but he's going to cause others to have their own mercy, and that's going to cause the Kadosh Baruch Hu to be merciful. Right? So if anything, it's a very positive feature. However, last paragraph, Ach v'yom ha-kippurim. However, on Yom Kippur, so Yom Kippur is a little more tricky, because Yom Kippur, he can't eat. And yes, it's true that under certain conditions, right, someone who's sick can eat, and maybe this individual who's going to collapse, maybe under certain conditions you would tell him you could eat, but if you are going to eat on Yom Kippur, you definitely cannot be davening. I mean, that's just, unfortunately, you cannot be davening if you're not fasting on Yom Kippur.
How about
the shir? As the chazi, you should daven the achidus, but not... It's a little bit tricky, but yeah, like even those individuals, like it's a little bit, I would say it's a case-by-case, you know, community basis, but even individuals who have to eat for medical reasons should probably not serve as a shir sibor, but it's not black and white.
How about if he was on IV before davening?
So IV might be a bit different.
Cool.
Because IV is not necessarily, it's not necessarily eating it. So that might be different.
He probably didn't have that then, but now.
Yeah, now it would be different. But I guess you could see the case. I mean, I have to see, I guess, the case of, the, you know, whether it's worth, you know, doing all these, like, you know, exigent measures just to be able to daven. Some people it really would matter because that's what they do every year.
Well, the idea is you do it before you go to shul.
Yeah. So, yeah.
He's the tenth man.
I just have a question about the controversy in Israel. What's the controversy about autistic people? They don't talk.
Well, I think it's probably this individual. Yeah, they talk, they disturb. Not only that, but if someone, you know, I mean, I don't know this particular individual they're talking about, but if someone, you know, does something bothersome to someone who's autistic, they could, you know, they could freak out. They could be very loud and disruptive. It, you know, it does happen.
There's somebody who occasionally is glossed the shoulder by his family members just yells out.
Yeah.
But, you know, we understand that and takes them out or quiets them down, brother or the father.
Yeah, no, it certainly can be disruptive. I'm not saying that they can't be disruptive. I think we have to admit, like, that the reality is true.
It happens, but, it's just, know, if you're an open-minded kind of place, you're going to not be disgusted by it, and therefore it's not also for him to be there, right? If it's a less open-minded place and they're disgusted by it, then maybe...
Yeah, and I think what the Chazon Sofer does well here is the answer is not, like, black and white. It's not like, oh, he definitely can come to shul, definitely can't come to shul. Chazon Sofer's answer is effectively, like, you are correct, there are concerns, but... how serious are the concerns? And B, can we do as much as we can to mitigate those concerns, right? What can I do pastorally, practically, to find ways of mitigating it? So this particular individual, have him eat, right? Someone who's autistic, maybe have him, you know, sit in the back of the shul, sit farther away from people, maybe get him in his own section, you know. Maybe there are ways to allow this individual to come to shul that don't disturb everyone else and, you know, allows this individual, though, to still be part of the community. So it's not enough to just say no. You have to take that next step of allowing them to come to shul. Actually, Moshe has, we're going to read the next shul, but has a very strong line about that that's worth, we're going to answer in a second. The next shul. Although, Chazon Sofer also is a Moshe, but Moshe is Sofer, I think. But Rav Moshe Feinstein has, in the next shul, we'll see, has a very strong line about that. But either way, when it comes to Yom Kippur, he won't be able to eat. And just because you're not allowed to daven is not going to be enough of a reason to allow you to eat. If you're going to collapse, it's a different story, but just to daven, that won't be enough to eat. Actually, the Chazon Sofer has a very famous tshuva, which is that if it comes down to going to shul, and the only way you're going to be able to go to shul on Yom Kippur is if you break your fast, or you don't break your fast, and you stay at home in bed all day, so Chazon Sofer says it's actually better to stay at home in bed all day. Even though it doesn't feel like the right Yom Kippur, it doesn't feel the right motivation, you know, emotionally it's a very difficult thing to say, but it, in terms of halacha, it's actually better to stay at home and fast on Yom Kippur. So, Chazon Sofer himself knows that, so, you know, it's his own tshuva. So here, as well, what do you do on Yom Kippur? So when it comes to Yom Kippur, it's a little bit trickier. Therefore, ach echlifu tfilato tfilat kol nidre v'yamor achar tatav le'mosaf. So what can you do? So it's an individual, you know, we don't have a solution for him to daven mosaf, but we shouldn't just not let him daven at all. Have him daven kol nidre. Since kol nidre is right after you eat, he should be fine by kol nidre. V'tov lo shi'amod beit tekneset, v'cheder ha'samuch beit tekneset. And not only that, but maybe you're concerned, you know, if he comes to shul, he might collapse, he might be disturbing. So, the Chazon Sofer doesn't say, you know, don't let him come to shul. He says, no, find him a space in the shul to be able to be there where he can, you know, have his own space, to find him a room adjacent to the shul. So at the same time, while we're going to make sure he doesn't be disturbed the shul, he'll still be able to come to shul, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu should give him a full refuah and should, you know, make him strong, such that this issue does not come up for him, and, you know, this is Rav Moshe's end, that Chatam Sofer's end, that he should, you know, give a refuah shleima to this individual. So, as I was saying, I think that it's clear here that, you know, Chatam Sofer is certainly saying yes, he should daven in some capacity. It's not black and white. It's, you know, a little bit more nuanced here. But Chatam Sofer certainly is not, like, ending the tshuva of, like, oh, you know what, like, this person's autistic, he can't come to shul, like, that's the end of the story. Chatam Sofer certainly would say, okay, even if I think that this individual disturbs people, let's find some means of bringing him to shul. Maybe we have to find him a different shul. That's, you know, maybe there's some shuls with a lot of kids, and that shul is not going to be a big deal to have, you know, a rowdier, you know, individual who might be a little bit more disturbing, because the shul already is a little bit louder. Maybe, you know, you can find him a different space in shul or a different minyan. You know, there are all sorts of solutions you can come up with that I think Chatam Sofer thinks are almost necessary for any rabbi to respond to and not just give up right away without, you know, just saying no. That's the first tshuva. The second tshuva is a tshuva written almost like 150 plus years later or so. This is a tshuva that Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote, and it's about whether or not you're allowed to bring a dog, a seeing-eye dog, for a blind individual.
We used to have somebody who came with a service dog who wasn't even blind. That person was allowed to bring the dog.
Yeah, it was a lady, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So this is Rav Moshe's question here. Exactly that question. Can you bring someone in? Because why wouldn't you be able to bring a dog? And what's the problem? Because animals in halacha are considered to be not particularly mechubad for you know, a holy space.
Especially dogs, right? I mean, dogs are terrible.
Yeah.
The cost of a dog to the mikdash or something like that, right?
Yeah, dogs are considered to be, yeah, I mean, especially nowadays we kind of have a different view of dogs, but certainly, you know. Yeah, I mean, it's still kind of true. Like, I don't think you can bring, like, an animal to, like, Buckingham Palace. Like, I think it's still kind of true.
Well, the Queen has dogs.
But not in Buckingham Palace.
Oh, she didn't have one in Buckingham
Palace. I'm, like, fairly certain about that, yeah. Mm-hmm. Even the Queen, who loved dogs and more probably than her own children, like, she still would, like, have some distance about where you have them and don't have them. So, all I know is from The Crown. I just watched a TV show. I don't know if it's accurate, but that's certainly the presentation they give. So can you bring a seeing eye dog who's not there, you know, because the dog's being disruptive? The point is actually the dogs are, A, well, very well trained, and without the dog, this individual can't really come to shul. So can this dog be brought to shul? So Rav Moshe is writing his tshuva in 1953, which is, I don't exactly know, you know, what people's attitudes were at the time, but I think Rav Moshe's tshuva here is fairly novel for the time period. I don't think people were as accommodating for disabilities at the time. So Rav Moshe writes the following tshuva, and he says,
Elizabeth.
Mordechai and Elizabeth. Here is the following: Yinei b'davar hasuma asher lamdu lekelev lo licho. So, regard to a blind individual who they taught a dog to walk with him or her, u'mochros kelev liot tamid etzlo, and the dog is always going to be with this individual. Imachol nikanes lebeit hakneset lipalel b'tzibor lishmua kaddish v'kedusha kriyat haTorah kriyat Megillah v'chadome af shekelev mochros likanesimo. So, can you allow bring in an animal into shul in order to allow this person to hear Kaddish and Kiddusha and Kriyas HaTorah and Megillah and all sorts of other, you know, things we do in shul? Or would it be an embarrassment, some type of disgrace for a shul, which is compared to a Beit HaMikdash, to bring an animal into shul?
Definitely couldn't bring an animal into the
Mikdash. Yeah. So, I mean,
cows and sheep.
Yeah, correct.
Except for all the animals that you are out there.
Well, other than the ones that are carbonic. You couldn't bring a dog into the meeting.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. Like, you're bringing in so many animals, but like, you can't bring out the animals.
Well, that means that Kalein, who was blind, was puzzled out of what he couldn't, but he couldn't bring a...
I mean, Cohen being blind, there's no way you could be in a vote-up.
Right, right.
Even nowadays, even nowadays, a blind Cohen probably can do a vote-up. It'd be too tricky.
But Dog couldn't even go to the Azvara with the Cohen going with him.
I mean, I don't think it would help in terms of the practicality of what a voter requires. Just, I mean, maybe I'm wrong. I'm not trying to remove people with disabilities, but I don't think it would help just practically. There's a lot of things you have to do. A dog wouldn't be enough. Like, you'd have to be a lot more. You have to do a lot more than that, but it's... but yeah, I think in terms of Cohen, it's a little bit trickier because Cohen is a little more formal, so it makes it a little bit more tricky in terms of, you know, being blind might just be a skill that you might just not really have so many ways of getting around, which is why Dochening is a little bit more complicated because it's modeled primarily off of a voter for Kohanim, so it's a little bit trickier in terms of what you do and can't do, you know. Can an individual who has to is wheelchair bound be a dochen? It's a little bit tricky. It's not so real. So it's a bit of a debate. It's not like, but it's not so simple one way or another. It's a bit of a debate. I'm not, you know, posking one way or another, but it's, you know, not, it's not so clear cut. Okay, so this is the Ramosha's answer. He quotes as follows: "V'hine itzav Yerushalmi perek b'nei ha'ir." So Ramosha quotes the Yerushalmi in Megillah says the following statement: Rabbi Ami said the following rule: Mifbud l'safri im ata barnash gabeichon milachlich boraita v'gabeichon tihave mekablin le v'chamrei ulmenui. He told the bookkeepers of his town. He said, if a individual who learns some Torah comes by you, then you should accept him and you should host him, and not only host him but host his animals, his donkey, and his utensils and his suitcase. V'hu mishum the silver Rabbi Yehuda ben Levi the Amar Sham le'el mizeh batei knesset batei midrashot the chachamim u'talmideim, and this is based on the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda ben Levi, who believes that the Beit Knesset and the Beit Midrash, right, the shul and the Beit Medrash, are designated for the sages and for their students.
I have a question.
Yeah.
You said bookkeeper, but I don't think you mean an accountant. I think you mean librarian.
I think it means like the shamish. The Safriya, yeah. Yeah, I think it's like the gabbai, the shamish, yeah. The Safriya, I mean, I think it means like the guy in charge of the books, but which is probably the shamish, yeah. Yeah, it's more librarian than not the accountant. I mean, he might also be the shul's accountant. But,
keeper of the books, not the book.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So the Chayin Amar Rabbi Ami was Safraya. So the same thing also happens in the Gemara and Megillah. It says the same thing, and like Bavli says the same thing. So the Chayin Amar Rabbi Ami was Safraya. She'af imhu rakstat ben Torah, nami nefshachkin ben Torah legabe zeh. And that's why your Ami says that even if you're only a little bit of a ben Torah, right? You're not particularly a Talmid Chacham, but like you learn a little bit. So even that's good enough that you should be able to sleep in the shul. Umotar kishu areach li'ot shavim chamaro v'chol kelav. And you're able to be in the shul with your donkey and with all of your belongings. And it's quoted by the Ron in Megillah, which means that, you know, it's effectively quoted by some Rishonim. This isn't just a random Yerushalmi. This is quoted l'halacha by many people. V'im kein chazinan, de'haknasat chamor lebeit ha'knesset, enu kalut rosh, u'bizayon yoter mechila v'shtia v'shena. And therefore we see that bringing a donkey into shul is no worse, it's no more disgraceful than eating or drinking or sleeping in a shul, the imhayayo termizeloy anita b'tamid chacham. Because if it was more than that, we wouldn't allow tamid chacham to do so, because tamid chachams are also required to not to be more a mikdash, and they can't, you know, they can't disgrace the shul either. So it's obvious then that if we can find a reason to allow an individual tamid chacham to sleep, to eat in a shul, which was certainly the minhag in Europe for, you know, a long time. To, you know, this, a shul and Beit Midrash was where people, guests, would come and sleep. That's where they would often be hosted.
Was it the shul also just the Beit Midrash?
It's probably both. And he's not differentiating, but it is true that there were often differences. Beit Midrash was usually considered to be a little bit lower than Beit Knesset. But... Yeah, certainly it's a very big question. But eating in shul is a very, very large question. Even, you know, the question of like a shul that has like a multi-purpose room, right? It's not so simple that you'd be able to use it as a multi-purpose room. It's not like so obvious. It's actually a very big question about can you do it, can you not do it. So Ramosha is really dealing with this type of issue of how you designate a room. In the next paragraph, he actually really goes into the issue because he points out, V'kevan churak yachila v'shtia, since it's only about eating and drinking, so let's talk about eating and drinking. Can you eat and drink in a shul? So lezeh behani tnaid v'teknesiot shebechutzaretz. So the Gemara records that in Bavel, they used to make a tnai, they used to make a condition that while the shul was being built, right, while the shul was being established, that the room, the shul, would be built on tnai, that you'd be able to use this room for other purposes than just prayer. Right? Because if you didn't do so, then presumably the shul is designated like a typical shul, which has a certain kedusha, and you wouldn't be allowed to eat or drink in the shul. But if you do it all tonight, if you know for sure, for instance, this Beit Midrash room, I'm sure when they built the Beit Midrash, they knew it'd be used for functions that also included food and kiddushes and lunch. So I'm sure when they designated they built the Beit Midrash, they thought to themselves, okay, it's going to serve multiple purposes, and one of them is going to be also eating. In which case, once you make that tonight, it's no longer going to be a problem to then have them.
I think when the shul was built, tonight was to eat anywhere except in the sanctuary.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if that was...
Did they make it tonight they could have concerts with that shul?
I don't know. We've had concerts in the sanctuary.
In
terms of eating, you're not supposed to eat in the sanctuary.
Like this shul is
Yeah, I'll be able to replace it. There's a lot of issues about shuls in theory that once they have a certain kedusha, you can't really do much with them. So most shuls nowadays are built on tanai, especially in chutzaretz. He quotes this in the that it's quoted based on the Gemara and quoted in the Ramban here that you're allowed to do this b'shat hadchach af lechol adam, even if you're someone who's not a talmid chacham, not someone who's a visitor in the place, even if you're a regular individual, then you'd be allowed to eat or drink in a shul. B'shat hadchach, in exigent circumstances. Now you might ask, I'll make it aside, why is it that Talmud Chacham can eat in shul but no one else can? Like why are we special at Talmud Chacham? It's not because there are special rules because they're holier. It's because they hang out, because we don't want to limit their Talmud Torah. Because if you're spending your whole day learning and davening, so if you had to go home every time you have to eat, then it would take away from your learning. So in theory, anyone who wants to learn, you know, all day, then that'd be true for you as well. This isn't just about your level of scholarship. It's really about... Yeah, so it would be a waste of time, it would be a digital Torah to be able to have to go back and forth, but this is true for anyone who would have such a, you know, predilection that they would be spending their time learning if it wasn't for the need for food. So the Ramban says that this is true. So the Gemara says this about Talmid Chacham, that Talmid Chacham can eat in a shul, and then because of this reason. The Ramban says that shuls that are built on tnai, that are built on this condition, they'd be able to use for multiple purposes. The Shas Adchak would be able to be used by everyone. Everyone, even non-Talmid Chacham, would be able to eat and drink in a shul, you know, under exigent circumstances. Shemihani etznai afilu b'yishuvan, l'inyan sh'imu sterchu anshe ha'ir la'achil b'hem aniyim, o la'ashkivam sham, because if you need, under certain circumstances, to feed people there, or to let them, give them a place to sleep, then that would be an exigent circumstance that you'd be allowed to have them rest there. And then our Moshe adds, alfa shev shochan aroch or achayim mashon shepsak de lo mehani t'nai klal. So this, our Moshe points out, is not so obvious, because the shochan aroch, a little bit later, seems to suggest he doesn't agree with this psak. Because the Ramban says the tanai works, but not everyone agrees with the Ramban. Some people think, no, a tanai would not work, and maybe the story that the Gemara quotes about people in Bavel making a tanai, maybe it was different in Bavel for whatever reason. But maybe you can't actually make a tanai. Maybe, you know, you can't have a multi-purpose room in a shul. This is certainly a position that some communities have. It's not so obvious you can do so. So Rav Moshe says, even though it's true, the Shulchan Aruch seems to potentially pass in that way, Aval, the Sifkatan Bet, Hevi Gam Shita Agavot Ashri, Vishem Or Zerua, She'al Tanai Shari, Afilu Bishuvan Lechol Vishtol Lechol Adam, Ach Shalom Yidochak. However, in a different sif in that Siman, the Shulchan Aruch quotes the opinion of those who disagree. And he quotes actually the opinion, the most extreme opinion, which allows you to eat in a shul with a tanai, even if it's not exigent circumstances. Even if you just, you know, you just want to have a kiddush. V'hagra, this is actually, really interesting in terms of the way Pesach works here. V'hagra, hebi haram, nishim ramban, she'al tanai, mota l'chol adam midochak. So the gra, the Vilna Gaon, Vilna, I'm turning his last name, Vilna, said that we paskin, at least the Shat Adchak, based on this Ramban, umashma sheposik, and it sounds like he paskins that way, v'lachain shafir posik mishnah brura of ber halacha. Aval shehechli smoch al Ramban, shekain sabri gamaran v'ashba, latir tu v'shuvan, l'chol apochol b'shat adchak. And so, of course, this is why the Mishnah Brura also paskins that at least b'shat adchak, you can rely on the position of the Ramban. So maybe, you know, this is a debate. Mishnah Brura, as we know, you know, often likes to hedge his bets and, you know, tends to be more machmir. So he's not ready to always permit it. But if there is a shot at chak, Mishnah Brura says, we can rely on the opinion of the Ramban. Yes, it might not be the only opinion here, but it's certainly enough in the shot at chak in a case of need. And why is he talking about all this? Because, just to be clear, bring it back to what we're talking about, a blind individual with a seeing eye dog is certainly a shat adchak, right? That would certainly be a need, a case of a need. So this is why he's talking about shat adchak, because this would be enough for shat adchak. Not only that, though, Rav Moshe makes this really interesting point. He says, and interestingly enough, Rav Moshe says, I know that there are many communities that not only are they mekel about letting you eat and drink with a tnai, when the shul is built on tnai, with shat adchak, but even when it's not shat adchak, they also have that practice. And he says, he quotes their shuls, l'sorach mitzvah ksat, even if there's like only a little bit of a mitzvah, you go and lechol sashishit. Like some shuls use, you know, their shul room in order to have shal shudis, right? They don't have any other space, and they use their shul for shal shudis. Even though the need is not so great, because you can always go home and eat shal shudas. You don't have to eat in shul. And yet people are still, minhag is certainly to, you know, permit it to eat in the shul. And even to have a kiddush for an ofra, for a bar mitzvah, people are nohig to be meko. Even though it's not clear that like, there's any mitzvah in having a kiddush. Maybe there's a mitzvah in having a meal, but having a kiddush, it's not really clear that there's a mitzvah of that. You know, there's no mitzvah of making a kiddush in shul. And yet, people still have that minhag to do so. And not only that, Rav Moshe quotes, the Hasidim, some Hasidic communities, I think in Belz, it's like really popular, they typically have, even for, you know, things which is religious verses, right? They have, like, their forbringings in shuls often. Mm-hmm. That's often their biggest space they have, and they have the bleachers.
Rabbi always had his forbringings at 770 in the main.
And they have in the main sanctuary. So, Chassidim, this is very common to have, you know, food. This is on a typical, you know, not a particular special occasion, just a typical, you know, I'm sure the Chassidim might say this is a mitzvah time, but Rav Moshe is saying, you know, so Kal v'chomer, like a forbringin, is not necessarily a mitzvah. It's a davar reshut. It's like a, you know, it's a voluntary act, and yet people that's the minhag to eat in shul. Avdavar reshut mashi had achila, and he quotes in other places like when it comes to eating and drinking for like yard sites. So im kein mochachim lomar shenoagim kirashi vagot ashiv shem avod shem or zeruah shemutu al tanai afilu bishuvan lachila v'shtia chagavna after the word chak. And so Rav Moshe makes this really interesting point that it seems that ultimately, if the custom of so many communities, right, of so many shuls and of so many Hasidic shuls, is that everyone seems to permit you to eat, it seems like the custom is that we paskin that, like the most nakal position, like the position of the Agot Ashri or Zeruah,
that you're allowed to eat in the shul, assuming it was built on a tanai, even if it's not Shadat Chak, right? It seems like we poskin that way.
So he's doing it on Rasukwa. They're all doing it, must be okay.
Yeah, and he, exactly.
Nobody wants to lose membership.
Yeah, no, but it's also, you know, maybe not 1953 when he wrote this, but certainly now it's a big revenue item for shuls.
Orthodoxy may not have been as popular, and they tell people want to
have yeah.
Culture. Right, but having weddings and fancy stuff and...
So this is a case of Pok Chavi Mayam Adavar.
Yes, it is. Actually, take a look at the next line. I actually never seen Ramosha say this until here. Menimsa shenipsak ata kein alacha, af imulai rak vidorot achroni mitchilu linhogein. Ramosha says, even if it's true that maybe the earlier generations paskened, you know, against this, right? It seems like, actually, take a look at Shulchan Aruch, it seems like Shulchan Aruch, at the very least, is only, anything in the Mishnah Berurah, it seems like Mishnah Berurah is only permitting Shasat Chak. Right, Mishnah Berurah doesn't say you're allowed to go and use the space, you know, for food, even, you know, not Shatat Chak reasons. And yet Rav Moshe says the fact that our community, from people, you know, not just the modern Orthodox, but, you know, all communities seem to allow food in their shuls suggests that the psak has changed and that nowadays we paskin like this other opinion. And then he quotes that there actually seems to be precedent for this in the Gemara, that the case from Rashi, the case is a little bit complicated, but there seems to be precedent that indeed, that if the minhag of the community seems to change, then that can change the psak. And Ramosha says, ach im lo neimaki chidusha de Rashi, even if you think of this principle, this idea that the psak can change, is a chidush, and you don't agree with it, because it's not so obvious. It's not so obvious that just because the minhag has changed the posture like this other opinion that all of a sudden now be permitted. Like if for many poskim that might be, you know, that's how psak works. We have a precedent. The precedent was we poskim a certain way. If everyone starts doing it the other way, that doesn't mean that the halacha changes. It just means they're doing it wrong. Right? It doesn't mean that, you know, it's permitted. So even if you disagree with Rashi, Rav Moshe says, even so, nonetheless, mikomako mishatat chak, nonetheless, at the very least, you can potentially paskin like Rashi Shavat Chak, and not only do you need to not paskin like Rashi about the way that, you know, psak is made, that potentially psak can change with time, but you also have the explicit opinion of the Ramban that as Shavat Chak, you're allowed to eat in a shul, right? And the Mishnah Berurah even quotes that. So if the Mishnah Berurah says that, you know, certainly you're allowed to rely on it, even the Shatat Chak. V'lachem, kevan shebeknesset chamor chazin, shebeknesset chamor chazin, shelo gar me'achilo v'shtia v'shena, and therefore, bringing us all back, if we see that you're allowed to eat and drink and sleep even in a shul, and certainly the minhag of eating and drinking, depending on the shul, but sleeping is certainly a very common minhag in shuls, sleeping is certainly a very common minhag in all shuls. So yesh la'atir v'etekasat shelanush al tanaihi nasuyos, and therefore we can permit a person to bring in a seeing eye dog in our shuls that are built al tanai im hu b'shatat chak. Any case with shatat chak, v'vaday shekelev logar mechamor, and of course a dog is no inferior or worse than a donkey. Right, a donkey certainly, yeah, I mean, especially nowadays, like, yeah. Dogs are tend to be clean and that are trained, and donkeys are...
Certainly in the Gemara, the Sherva Chamor, yes, nobody had a Kelo.
Yeah, certainly nowadays, but like a donkey is a much more, you know, grosser animal. Yeah. I mean, just take a look at Central Park and you'll see all the horse droppings. I mean, it's certainly a less, you know, less cleanly animal in general. And not only that, where Moshe says, not only is this potentially a Shatat Chak, but there's no bigger Shatat Chak. Because if you don't allow this individual to come to shul, it's not that you're saying, oh, you can't come to shul on any given Shabbos, I mean, you know, a particular, you know, last Shabbos, whatever it is, May 20th. What you're really saying is, this individual can't ever come to shul. Right. He can never daven in shul. He can never come to hear Megillah reading. He can't hear Kiyas Shofar. He can't hear Kiyas Torah. He can't come for bar mitzvahs. He can't come for any communal events. And that is a real Shatat Chak.
The gam yesh yamim she'agmat nefesh gedola me'od. And not only that, but there are some days where people have this intense need to go to shul. There is a, you know, intense emotional need, such as on Yomim Nerayim, on high holidays. People sometimes really feel that I have to go to shul. Especially on days where, you know, the community as a whole all gathers to go to shul, you feel you need to go to shul. And it's also true, I mean, he doesn't mention this here, but, you know, there are days where, you know, there's something personal that happened to you, and you feel like you want to go and pray. Something, you know, is happening in your life that, you know, is troublesome, is, you know, that you feel like you need a refuah of some sort, and you want to go to shul.
You even have to bench
government. Yeah.
Youth
yeah, whatever, you know, any of these types of situations that has not just, you know, a typical need, but has a real emotional pull, and your emotion is saying, that's a real shatat chak. You're never going to allow this individual to go to shul. That's a real shatat chak. And therefore, shelachin raya gedola sheish la'atir la'asuma shakela shemulicho shetarech liyot etzot tamid lichares v'et eknetzu l'talel l'shmur kentzor v'chadome. So, therefore, Ramosha says, it's definitely permitted to allow a seeing eye dog to accompany this individual to come to shul so that this individual can hear Kriyas Torah, Megillah reading, and all other sorts of things. Ach, tov sheyeshev samuch la'pesach shelo l'davel l'sibur. However, this is kind of the nuance here, Ramosha does that. At the same time, because I am concerned that potentially the dog might disturb people in davening, this individual should ideally sit near the entrance. Now, of course, it might be, this is very much sociological dependent. I think, you know, depending on your sociological reality, some places it might not be so disturbing to have a dog. I actually think dogs tend to be disturbing a little bit because just like everyone wants to play with a dog. They're very cute. But especially in a time where, you know, where they are disturbing, your emotion is saying, you know what, you're disturbed by the dog, sit in the front. Don't look at it. But, you know, this individual still should have the right to come to shul. He doesn't even say this, but the dogs, like, seeing eye dogs are, like, particularly well-trained. Like, they're really not, you know, disruptive.
I've never heard a seeing eye dog bark.
Yeah, they're, like, they're trained to be really, you know, so it's, like, really not a problem in that sense. But certainly it's a question. And your emotion says you're allowed to bring them, but, you know, because we want to be concerned with, you know, the other people in the shul, so, you know, try to minimize the disruption, sit near the entrance of the shul. Not only that, but Ramosha also makes the following argument, which I think is a really interesting argument. I actually never seen anyone paskin explicitly like this, but I think it's an interesting point. Megam ishli stapek. Not only that, not only is it true that based on my whole analysis of Shatat Chak, you'd be allowed to bring a tzna, you'd be allowed to eat and drink and bring your donkey in, so therefore you can also bring a dog. But Ramosha says, it's also not clear that it's really a bizayon to bring a seeing eye dog to shul. Like, why is that so obvious that bringing a dog into shul when their dog is serving a clear medical purpose, why is that, you know, a disgrace? Because ela shech bizayin mekolot rosh bechnisat behema ela shechnisa he shelo tzarech tefila ela tzarech hitachnut ke'uvda d'Yerushalmi. So the case of Yerushalmi, right, the case of the donkey, that's a case where the donkey is just like your animal. That's just like, you know, your mode of transportation. So leave your bike outside. You know, you leave your, you know, your motorcycle outside. Like, who says that, like, you should bring your mode of transportation into shul? But that's very different from a seeing eye dog that's being brought for the purpose of davening. It's not for the purpose of, you know, anything else. It's for davening. Therefore, it's possible it's not actually kalut rosh at all. And therefore, maybe we can even be more makeless. And Ramosha mentions his question was asking, you know, from Elizabeth, which is, you know, in Chutz Laaretz, but this might have implications for shuls that are built in Eretz Yisrael, because it's not so simple to make a tanai in a shul in Eretz Yisrael. In Israel, in terms of making a tanai in a shul, it's a lot more complicated because the precedent the Gemara gives is specifically in Bavel. So it's not so clear that you can do so in Eretz Yisrael. In Chutz Laaretz, it's a lot more simple. In Eretz Yisrael, though, it's a little bit trickier. So Ramosha says, even if you know, Paskin, which is honestly probably the normative stock, you're not allowed to have food and drink inside a shul in Eretz Yisrael, even if it's built all tanai, nonetheless, a seeing eye dog is not really the same type of disturbance. It's meant for davening. However, I'm still hedging. I'm not entirely sure this is a great proof. So I'm not entirely sure. I'm not really going to give a set answer for Eretz Yisrael shuls. I think in our shuls, in Eretz in Chutzlar, it's a clear, good proof. You're allowed to bring a seeing eye dog into shul. And I think in actually most communities in America at this point, even within more firm communities, this is pretty common stock to allow, dogs or other helpful, aids for anyone who's handicapped in some way or disabled in some way.
Electrical wheelchair.
That's your wheelchair. Yeah, it's pretty common. It's pretty common. I will point out that I know, I think it was last year, they had an event in the main sanctuary after davening with, I can't remember who it was. I'm blanking out the name of who it was. But someone who does trauma, who deals with trauma, post-trauma, she works these post-trauma teams in Israel, go around the world whenever some traumatic event happens. And she, and her specific specialty is she has therapeutic dogs who help with the therapy in a way that sometimes humans can't, but sometimes dogs sometimes unleash a certain emotional response that can be very therapeutic. So I remember, Rabbi Robinson told me, he asked Rav Schechter, can she bring the dog in to shul to demonstrate, what it looks like and to bring the dog in. And so Rav Schechter said that, maybe there would be potential reasons to be matir, but he felt that that wasn't enough because it's just a demonstration. It's not really serving a purpose of what?
Of tefillah.
It's not serving the purpose of davening. It's just serving a demonstration of what it looks like, after davening. So that he didn't feel it was enough to allow the dog into shul. Even though this dog is also very well trained, obviously, because it's, a therapeutic dog in this context.
They could have done it in the ballroom.
They could have done it in the ballroom. Yeah, I think.
They have a ballroom.
Well, it was here in shul. They could have done it in Lincoln Square. They could have done it in the ballroom, but yeah, I guess they decided it was probably.
One of the dogs in the ballroom we're going to have to
They probably decided they didn't need to have the dog for the presentation, but, it certainly it's not so simple to have animals in shul, but it's,
We just like the ballroom. Walking
through
into the shul, and we
daven
in the ballroom.
Yeah, so.
It's not the ballroom.
Yeah.
We're saying ballroom, but it could be the ballroom.
Yeah, it's also the shul. We
daven
there, too. So I.
And then walk into the
building. Yeah, so I think of the two tshuvas, Chatzim Sofer and Igros Moshe, what you see here is that it's not so clear-cut, and it's always mutter. It's not what they're saying. There are reasons why it'd be disturbing, why potentially there is a Kedusha Beit Knesset, and this individual shouldn't come to shul for whatever reasons, or shouldn't daven a shliach tzibur. But at the same time, they're going as far as they can to find ways in order to allow them, to find ways that this is considered shat adcha, to concede that not allowing them into shul is a significant impairment on them, and that we as a community need to do whatever we can to allow them into shul, encourage them to come to shul, and find the means of, of allowing them and, providing that avenue for them in shuls.
Oh, that's great.